Hello, and welcome to the Queen's Observatory Fast Radio Bursts. I am Connor Stone, here with my co-host, Nikhil Arora. It is our mission to bring exciting space news hot off the telescope and into your ears. One way or another, the Queen's Observatory has continued its practice of sharing the wonders of the universe since 1857. Thank you for joining us in this long-running tradition. Here at Fast Radio Bursts, we will answer your questions, interview astronomers, and dive deep into breaking research. From low Earth orbit to the clouds of Venus, from Betelgeuse to colliding black holes, it's a big universe to talk about, so let's get started.
And welcome back to Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. I'm your host, Nick, and we have another interview today. We have today with us Charles, who generally goes by CJ. So for the rest of the interview, I'm going to call him CJ. Hi, CJ. How are you doing?
I'm good, Nick. How are you doing?
I am great as well. I hope everybody listening in is also keeping safe and healthy in these times. And I'm excited for what we have in store today. I think through my experience of doing public outreach, I've realized there are two very famous topics which people get very interested in. One of them is aliens, which makes sense. And then the second one is black holes. And CJ, you are an expert in understanding black holes in the universe. So this will be an exciting time. Okay, so before we get started, let me introduce you a little bit. Let me build up sort of CJ. So CJ, Dr. Charles Woodford, let me put it that way, is a knowledge translation specialist at the McDonald Institute here at Queen's University. He's been in Kingston for about a year, right?
A little bit less. We moved in June of 2021.
Okay. So yeah, he's a new Kingstonian, if I can add. So you're a pandemic mover. Yeah. I'm hoping that wasn't too stressful.
I think moving is always stressful.
I do know that for sure. CJ, you got your bachelor's in physics and applied mathematics from the Memorial University of Newfoundland, where you also are originally from. But something interesting that we're going to talk about in a minute, as well, as that you did a minor in Russian studies, which I find very interesting, for sure. And then you moved to University of Toronto to do a PhD in theoretical and numerical astrophysics. And now you are here at Queen's. So the structure of the podcast today is going to be all about black holes when we start today. And then we're going to move to sort of the second part of your job, which is sort of an education consultant or a knowledge translation specialist, both either at Discover the Universe or at the McDonald Institute. I feel like, so I've only done like 3 or 4 of these interviews. Before that, Connor was doing most of the interviews, but all 2 out of my 3 interviews have been with people who have been from the east side of Canada. And both those people seem to be experts in education, outreach, and knowledge translation. So it seems like there's a theme going on. We should look into what's going on in the Maritimes for sure with these people. Okay, so let's get started, CJ. Let's start with some sort of a motivational question that motivates. What got you interested into physics? And then from physics, what got you motivated into theoretical astrophysics?
Yes, that's a really good question. And just to be clear, like, I don't know if we, those of us on the East Coast of Canada, necessarily have a big motivation for education and outreach. I think that's a total coincidence.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, in science, we say correlations are not causations, but...
Totally. But you're right, that's suspicious. But why I got interested in physics? So I guess... kind of, you know, the maybe your traditional reason, definitely in like a grade school level when I was, you know, when you're in like grades 4, 5, 6 and all the way up through junior high and high school, when physics actually starts being its own subject. And definitely had interest there just because I really liked the logical progression of how physics was taught. I really liked how it really played into rationing out a way on why phenomena happen in the world. But I think that even kind of goes back further when physics isn't necessarily its own standalone subject, when you're kind of learning about science in general. So even at that point, I was still really fascinated by what I now know is kinematics, dynamics, how things move, why they move, and a way to predict what's going to happen in certain scenarios and situations. And I guess even kind of moving away from physics, that's the physics motivation right there. And really loved physics in high school, especially when it was his own subject and you got to really dive into the history of stuff as well. But moving into, say, like astronomy and astrophysics, that's actually from like a childhood fantasy of wanting to be an astronaut. and I say it's a fantasy because, as I'm sure most people are aware, being an astronaut is no joke. you know, you got to be the top of not just like an academic and intellectual game, but also the top of your physical game. And so, you know, I really did want to be an astronaut. But when I was 9, I was diagnosed with diabetes, type 1 diabetes to be specific. And so that was like, I mean, a big blow in general, because you don't want to be diabetic in general. But that was particularly difficult, especially when I started getting old enough to realize what that meant in terms of my future, that being an astronaut was definitely not in the cards. But I definitely grew up really interested in space, definitely interested in physics. And in particular, being from Newfoundland, I grew up in a semi-rural area. I'm not going to say it was rural Newfoundland, because that has its own completely different definition. But we didn't have any light pollution where I lived. And so very clear visuals of the stars, very clear visuals of the sky. And so like kind of an organic interest in knowing and kind of figuring out what was I looking at and why did it look the way it did. So yeah, kind of inspiration from a couple of different angles, I guess.
I guess. Yeah. So it's interesting. Your and my story is very similar. I wanted to be an astronaut too. That's how I started out. And then I was talking to one of my uncles and he just talked me out of being an astronaut. He said, being an astronaut is boring.
What?
Exactly. Because he was like, you just get to go to space maybe once or twice in your life. Who wants to do that? Which I guess is true, but those are two very epic journeys in your life.
Oh, you only have to go to space once or twice. Excuse me. I'll take that. Thank you.
Yeah.
What? then,
but then later on, I also started, I was fairly active as a sports person, and I started getting injuries while playing sports. And that kind of knocked me out of the path of being an astronaut. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll do astrophysics now, which always sounds weird to say, but yeah, this is interesting. I'm quite happy about that. Okay, so maybe this is sort of moving away from astrophysics for a minute as well, but I want to have our viewers listen, or our listeners listen to this part as well. When you were doing your bachelor's, you of course did the bachelor's in physics, but what made you minor in Russian studies? I think it's always important to show people that when you go into university, especially because some of our listeners are moving into universities, choosing a major doesn't always close doors for you. So I think you're a perfect example of that. So why did you choose Russian studies?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And maybe also just emphasizing for the listeners that, you know, the original purpose of a university was to learn more and to accumulate knowledge and to investigate things that interest you. So keeping that in mind, that was why I pursued Russian studies. But even more than that, when I was kind of getting ready to apply to university, I was like, yeah, I definitely want to do physics and math together, because honestly, it was kind of a borderline for me on whether or not I wanted to go into mathematics primarily or physics primarily. Really, really love math even today. But I was kind of, the goal that I set for myself, I was also going to do a double minor in chemistry and Russian. And I very quickly dropped that chemistry minor after hearing the horror stories of organic chemistry from folks that I did some research with. Yeah, so I mean, like, yeah, I was like, you know what? I don't need to punish myself that much. I don't need to do organic chemistry. That sounds awful. Apologies to all the chemists in the audience. But I guess in terms of why Russian in particular, I think it kind of links back to my dad, honestly. My dad is not a historian or anything like that per se. He's actually a mechanical engineer, but he had a really big fascination with military history, and especially histories of the First and Second World War. And so growing up, there was a lot of, you know, books in our household, history documentaries, you know, even like fictional history movies and things like that. So I got kind of like through osmosis, learned a lot about Russia indirectly, and also learning about the Cold War and whatnot. And so when I was in high school, and, you know, usually when you get into high school, you have subject specific courses. I started taking more Russian language courses, especially when I moved out of my more rural family home and into the larger city in St. John's of Newfoundland, where I had more opportunity for those subsidized courses. And so when I went to university, I was like, I really do want to pursue, you know, learning Russian, learning about Russian culture and history, because I felt like it was just something that always really interested me. And it's also a perspective that's very different, that we don't normally get in North America. Like, there's still very much like an anti-Russian feeling in some places in North America. And I was like, well, why? Like, so anyway, that was kind of my motivation for that. And it was a lot of fun and I loved it. I am definitely not fluent in Russian anymore. It's I haven't practiced in a really long time. but I did actually go to Russia for a semester, well, a summer abroad, I guess, more accurately. And that was an incredible experience. So yeah, definitely following that, you know, university is a place to learn and a place to accumulate knowledge more so than just get like a means to an end for a job or what have you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of the times when I'm having conversations with either young undergrads or about to be undergrads, their focus is definitely on either the grades or the kind of job they're going to get at the end.
For sure.
And so I think you model a perfect example of this is a place which is abundant in knowledge. Mm-hmm. And if you can absorb even some of it, independent of what grades you get, you're going to be fine at the end of the day. But also, you're going to have a lot of fun if your approach is towards knowledge and getting to know things, then I guess numbers on your transcript to some extent.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I definitely panicked about those two.
Oh, yeah. I agree. No, no. I guess it won't be university if you don't panic about those.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. So let's continue sort of discovering your story a little bit more. What made you focus on black holes? from astrophysics, I guess. I mean, everybody wants to do black holes. I wanted to do black holes when I was a kid, and they're really the popular topic. But what got you interested about black holes specifically?
So this is what I think is kind of funny, is that I did not have a preference for black holes. really, I didn't. It was a complete kind of like happy accident. I actually technically started researching when I was in grade 11. Like still in high school, I was in like a partnering program with the university, and I started out doing research in earth science and geophysics, surprisingly. Right. I then went from there to doing research in the chemistry department at the Memorial University of Newfoundland, kind of like the resident physicist on the team. And then they did Kelvin probe force microscopy, which was amazing, looking at like looking at molecules in real time. It was really, really awesome. And then when I decided, you know, I really do want to pursue research in astronomy or astrophysics, MUN, or the Memorial University of Newfoundland, we abbreviate it to MUN, does not have an astronomy department. It doesn't have an astronomy sub-department. The physics department is the Department of Physics and Physical Oceanography.
Okay.
There's no astronomy in there. Yeah, it makes sense given where it is. But that also means that, you know, as someone who was looking at doing, say, an honors thesis in astronomy and astrophysics, like it was kind of hard to figure out, like, who do I talk to and all that stuff. So in the physics department, there was one professor, there was one faculty member who did anything related to astronomy and astrophysics. And then there was a couple of people in the math department as well, I found out through conversations later, but they all focused on gravity, general relativity, and black holes, with a couple of folks in the math department kind of going really hard into topology and that sort of thing. So it was actually through that work experience that through my honors thesis in undergrad, it just happenstance the only astrophysicist in the physics department did general relativity and gravity work. He didn't even really do black holes. He did globular clusters, which are kind of which are star clusters. We see them in the Milky Way and stuff. So it was trying to figure out dynamics and how do things move and how do you include a more cohesive picture of gravity in there that's not just Newtonian gravity. And it was through that work, which was very heavily computational, that when I started looking at grad school, I was like, you know, I like gravity and I like general relativity and I like the idea of looking at gravitational radiation. So it was actually like gravitational radiation that got me looking at gravitational waves and black holes.
Right.
And then there was only one person who did, you know, that sort of thing in Canada at the time. And that's why I applied to U of T, and that's how I got to do the rest of it. It was kind of this happy accident of, you know, we only had one person in the physics department and that's what he did.
Right. Oh, that's cool. Okay. So let's then dive into the science here a little bit. Let's start with some basic definitions. You dropped a couple terms there, which I feel would be cool to define here. Let's start with sort of your bottom shelf definition, like easiest to get the cookies kind of definition for black holes and then gravitational waves.
Yeah, totally. I went right into the jargon there a bit. Sorry about that. So bottom shelf definition of the black holes. How do you get those delicious, delicious black hole cookies? so I guess something to keep in mind when you're talking about black holes is that they are, you know, some of the most extreme exotic objects in the universe that we know of, you know, little TM that we know of. That's really important. And I think instead of, I think I also like talk about how they're made a little bit too. I think that's important, but the basic thing to remember about black holes, you know, the classic piece that's really important to keep in mind is actually how they interact with light. So why do we call them black holes? Kind of like why the word black? Black hole is a region where gravity is so strong that light cannot escape. And keep in mind that light is the fastest thing in the universe. That's actually a rule from special relativity. There you go, learning things all the time. But you can also kind of think about this as escape velocity. You know, you have a rocket, and if it doesn't reach a certain speed as it's ejecting itself from the atmosphere, it's not actually going to escape Earth's gravity. It doesn't get to the moon, or it doesn't get to the ISS or whatever it's trying to get to.
Right.
So for black holes, that would be the escape velocity for the boundary of a black hole is the speed of light. So inside of that, the escape velocity is higher than the speed of light, and that's impossible. Therefore, nothing escapes. So that's how I think about that. And that's technically the definition of what we call the event horizon, the boundary of the black hole. So that's the really important thing to remember. It's black holes are a region in space where the gravity is so strong that not even light can escape.
Right.
Once it interacts with it and gets close enough. But there are like a lot of different ways that black holes can be thought of. There's different masses. They come in a bunch of different varieties and forms, and there's different equations that describe them. We're not going to get into the equations, don't worry. But like they do have a bunch of like flavors, if you will. Vanilla black hole, a chocolate black hole. But really, the other thing to think about them is, another way is to think about how do they get formed? And that might be a good way too. Yeah. So we know what they are, at least in terms of like a basic definition, but the small ones that we know how they're created, we know that they're created when stars burn through all of their fuel, especially the big stars when they go supernova. They, after the explosion, the material of the star will fall back in on itself. And if that star was large enough, it'll collapse. It's just too dense to sustain itself. And it collapses and basically causes a rip in reality. And that's actually what causes that really extreme gravity that prevents light from escaping, or that doesn't allow light to escape. So they're really, really dense. They don't allow light to escape. And the ones that we know of, the small ones that have been detected reasonably well, they're kind of like the husks of dead stars.
Yeah.
Or what comes after the stars go supernova in some cases.
Right. Cool. So black holes are essentially zombie stars, if that's one way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, well, more like, I think there's a couple of things that could be described as zombie stars. So let's say they're the fast zombies. They're very active. So they're like the zombies that run at you. They're not the slow zombies. There's slow zombie versions of stars too, folks. They're called brown dwarfs.
Right.
But the black holes are definitely the angry zombies.
Okay, we're reaching towards the end of the segment here, and I want to get one more definition out of you before we dive into your research, particularly. And that's gravitational waves. So once again, let's go down to the bottom shelf. And what are gravitational waves?
Yeah, so gravitational waves are ripples in space-time. So I said black holes are rips in reality, or rips in space-time. And so gravitational waves themselves are ripples in space-time, or in our reality is another way to think about that. Space-time just being the fabric of space and time that we exist in. And so gravitational waves are, they're energy that move through space-time. And what they do, it's maybe also kind of easier to think about what they do as they move. They cause directions to stretch and compress as they move through. So as a gravitational wave is moving through space-time, it'll stretch in one direction and compress in another. And it's called a wave because of how we detect it, really. But you can also think about it in terms of if you put a stick in a pond, or you throw a stone into water, for example, and it causes ripples on the way out.
Yeah.
The rip, like that is the best analogy. One of the best analogies for gravitational waves moving through space-time is like they literally are ripples moving through the same way that you would have ripples moving through water if you threw a stone into it.
Okay, good. Yeah, so I guess this is a great time to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to sort of combine those two things, black holes and gravitational waves, and see what kind of science we can draw out of it. See you soon.
Hello, Connor here. I'm just stopping by to let you know that the Queen's Observatory is always here to answer your space questions. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube by searching for Queen's Observatory, and looking for our logo. There will also be links to all of our online channels in the podcast description. We're always happy to talk about the universe, and if you ask a really big question, we just might have to do a podcast about it. That's all from me. Time to learn more about our amazing universe.
And welcome back. We are here with CJ talking about black holes. So that's interesting, always. And so CJ, now let's dive into the main focus of your research. And you study, you're focused on binary black holes, which is interesting because black holes is couples. One black hole was interesting enough, and now you have two of them. So why do black holes exist as couples? And how many of the black holes can we estimate in the universe, or even our galaxy for that matter of fact, that live as binary stars, binary black holes system?
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting question, because it's not necessarily that black holes only exist in binaries or that they're always coupled together. You'll certainly have black holes that exist on their own. And what might even be more common is actually black holes existing in more complicated systems. So like in triplets, in quadruplets, in many body systems. It's just that how we tend to detect them, which I will get to probably a little bit later, is that we tend to detect them as binaries, two in a pod, twice the black hole for half the price. So, but to get to maybe your point on like, you know, how many and why do they even be in binaries? How does that even make sense?
Right.
So first of all, there's a lot of black holes. Just in case someone ever said to anybody listening that black holes are not common, they are. There's a lot of black holes. Not like on Earth, that not like that, but in the universe and even within the Milky Way galaxy. So we know that even within our Milky Way galaxy, there's probably on the order of 100 million stellar mass black holes, or black holes that are around the mass of a star. A typical star, right. like a little bit larger than our sun. And we know that most galaxies have a supermassive black hole in them. So things that are like 100,000 times the mass of our sun. And so knowing...
Just a lower estimate, might I just add.
That's a lower estimate. Yeah, they can be millions of times the mass of the sun for sure. And so thinking about that in terms of from the Hubble telescope, we know that there's billions of galaxies out there.
Yeah.
At least that we've seen, and you know, TM, you know, that we know of. So you know, thinking about it that way, there are billions of black holes of all shapes out there, or sizes I should say, masses might even be more accurate. And so then thinking about, you know, how many might there be in binaries? Well, as these objects, like any other objects, like stars for example, moving through space, moving through star clusters, moving through the galaxies, et cetera, et cetera, they are going to be likely to interact with other things, right? So it's not going to happen all the time. You'll certainly have things that are by themselves, but they exist as binaries because it is definitely more likely that one thing will interact with one other thing than opposed to a bunch of other things in that same time frame, with the exception being really crowded areas of a galaxy, such as star clusters, where there's a lot of things in a very small distance. But as I mentioned before, you know, black holes can certainly be in more complicated systems. There's nothing that says that they can only be in binaries. They can be in tertiary systems, you know, four body, five body, n body, as many things that they can interact with as possible. But in terms of how many actually exist in the binaries, I think that you can probably take a lesson from stars. It's estimated that, because we know that the number of black holes, especially stellar mass ones, the ones that are on the order of a few solar masses, they're going to be... It's about one black hole for every 10 stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Yeah. We know that, and we're estimating that about 85% of the stars in the Milky Way galaxy are actually in complicated systems like binaries, free body problems, etc. Probably something like 85% of all of those billions of black holes in the universe are in complicated systems like binaries, three body systems, or more. So there's just, things are a lot more complicated than just floating around in empty space, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. So this is just a direct result of the fact that given that stars live in multiple object systems, they just almost translate into black holes living in multiple object systems.
Yeah, and that's also because one of the ways that we think binary black holes exist, like come into existence, is that you'll have a binary star system, like two stars that are orbiting around each other, and one of them will turn into a black hole, and then the other one will turn into a black hole. And what do you have left? You have two black holes orbiting around each other. So that's one of the most common estimates of how binary black holes even come into existence, is that they originally started as a stellar binary.
Okay. So. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Let's move in to black hole mergers and gravitational waves. First of all, I guess it's worth asking, if there are two black holes living in a single system, why do they have to merge? On what scales? Or how long does it take for them to merge? And once they release gravitational waves, what do those gravitational waves tell us about? I guess this is too big a question. So let's start with, why do binary black holes have to merge, and how long does it take them to merge?
All right, that's also kind of a big question, but yeah. So you might remember that I was when I was saying about I was working in my undergrad on N-body systems, and specifically globular clusters. Now, those are not necessarily black hole systems, although now it looks like they might be. Eyebrow raise. But there's a lot more to gravity than we give it credit for. It's not just the gravitational constant G on the surface of the Earth. There's a lot more going on there than Newtonian gravity. And so for black holes, as they move through space-time and orbit around each other, they are emitting gravitational radiation, or energy that is that's a result of gravity, of their own gravity even, and interacting on each other. And so that emission of energy, by definition, means that they're losing energy from the system. And if you're losing energy from a system where they're orbiting around each other, they're going to in-spiral. They can't maintain their velocity. They can't maintain a perfect orbit where they're completely stable. And so as they in-spiral, they get faster, and they will merge when they get to the end of that in-spiral. So it's a direct result of that gravitational radiation, which is emitted from the system as gravitational waves.
Right.
And just to be clear as well, something I missed earlier was that gravitational waves are a direct cause of matter moving through space-time. So we definitely have more loud, if you will, or strong gravitational waves from extreme objects like black holes, but gravitational waves are actually caused by any matter moving through space-time. Like my dog walking is causing a gravitational wave, a very specific dog-shaped gravitational wave.
Okay, great. That was going to be my exact next question, so good.
How long does it take? So that is directly related to, you know, how far away are the black holes when they are, you know, quote unquote captured, or they start going in, or they start orbiting around each other? How big are they? Like, how massive are they? How fast were they moving originally? Is it, an evolutionary system, like with the stars that go supernova and they're already in an merger? Or was it dynamically captured? Like a black hole whizzes by another one and it's captured and then it goes orbiting. The eccentricity of the orbit, like things like that, that are more about the dynamics of the system, are going to tell you a little bit more about how long it'll take and what that looks like. But what I can say is that it can definitely take on the order of, you know, years, tens of thousands of years, millions of years, et cetera, depending on just how large this system is. But when you get down to, and I know we're going to talk about detecting in a second, but when you get down to what we actually detect in terms of gravitational waves, that's going to be on the order of seconds, and more likely milliseconds and nanoseconds. In those last few orbits, black holes will be going at almost the speed of light in their in-spiral.
Right. Oh, wow. Okay. So I guess maybe that sort of moves us into the next question. Is there more information that you get apart from how fast these black holes are moving when you look at gravitational waves? What do gravitational waves tell us about black hole merger specifically?
I think that's something that, you know, even I wasn't really thinking about originally, because when you see a gravitational wave, like the actual data you get from the observatories, it's a wave. It's a waveform like you would see, not exactly, it does have specific features, but it's a waveform that has an amplitude and a frequency and a phase. And those are quantities that you get familiar with, say, in like grade 11 and grade 12 math. And, you know, those are things that people can calculate, you know, from a pretty early stage. Gravitational waves are a little bit more complicated. They change in time and that sort of thing. But once you get out those pieces, like the amplitude, the frequency, the phase, how fast is the frequency changing? How fast is the amplitude changing? Is the amplitude shrinking at or growing at a particular rate? Is it steady? Is it linear, et cetera? All that information, so like this primary and secondary and tertiary information you get from the wave itself, that's actually what tells you about the system. And so from that, you can get the information such as, what was the ratio between the masses of the black holes? And from that, you can say, how massive was each black hole? An approximate, of course. How far away was the black hole? where in the sky did the signal come from? And then likewise, where was that binary system? You can say how long ago it happened. You can say physical parameters such as the spins on the, by the way, black holes spin, fun fact. So, you know, did they, were they spinning? How fast were they spinning is, you know, how fast, quote unquote. You can say like how eccentric was the orbit, and then that could tell you, was it a stellar system that we created the two black holes, or were they, was it dynamic capture? So you can really get a lot of cool information. And just a very small side note on this, even though I really looked at the binary black hole piece, you can actually see gravitational waves for other binary systems like neutron stars, which is another really cool exotic feature. And when you talk about things that are actually made of matter, not matter, sorry, black holes are made of matter, but when you're talking about things that have like actual interiors that have fluid and, you know, plasma and stuff inside, the gravitational wave can actually tell you a lot about the equation of state or the interior of those compact stars, which is an open research question as well. So you get a ton of information from the gravitational wave, really.
Okay. I guess this wealth of information needs to be measured, needs to be detected. And so just a natural question following that is, well, how do you measure or how do you detect these gravitational waves?
Yeah. So there's a few different theories on how you can do it, but the one that's been tried and true, and definitely the one that like folks have definitely heard of the most, is laser interferometers, and thinking in particular of the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. Now expanded to the LIGO-Virgo collaboration. And believe me, there are more detectors coming down the line, folks. So what these laser interferometers do, and just to be clear, laser interferometers are used for a lot more than just, not just, sorry. They're used for a lot besides gravitational wave detection. We use them in a lot of, you know, subatomic particles, nuclear physics, and so on and so forth, as well as medical physics. There's laser interferometer work. But for gravitational waves specifically, what happens is they will... shoot lasers down two tubes, usually vacuum sealed. The laser light will bounce off the end of each tube, bounce back to the source. And the idea is that if the tubes are exactly the same length, it's a little more complicated than that because usually it's to do with wavelengths of light. But for the case of argument, in this case, an analogy, they're the same length. When the laser light comes back, it should destructively interfere or cancel out. And so if the lengths of the tubes are not the same length, when that laser light comes back, it won't completely cancel out. And that's what constitutes a signal. When I mentioned before about gravitational waves, they stretch and compress in two different directions. And they alternate on that base, like as the wave passes through, as they go through peaks and troughs, they'll stretch and compress differently in different directions. And so what you have when something passes through a laser interferometer, like a gravitational wave, is that you'll have one arm stretch and the other one compress, and then they'll alternate. And that will, and that's actually what you'll then see in the laser light, is that the laser light will get brighter and dimmer as that wave passes through. So it's not very strong light. I'm kind of making it sound like you could see it with your eyeball, and you can't. You can't. It's a very, very small measurement. And so for gravitational waves from black holes, it's the strongest gravitational waves that we're ever going to see, really. The length of the arms, how much they change, is on the order of 1/1000th the diameter of a proton.
Yeah.
Like the subatomic particle. 1/1000th the diameter of a proton is how much they move. So you need a very sensitive laser. You need very sensitive equipment, very accurate lasers, really long arms, actually, on the gravitational wave detectors. So you need to have them really long. And you need more than one, because then you need to verify if something that small, you should be able to see it in more than one detector. In the right time span. And so that's why this was such a big undertaking, and why adding more detectors is so important, because you're able to have better resolution and more confidence in your detections and your calculations of things as well. And just be really clear as well, like detecting something that small of an effect, that's the most accurate sensitive measurement that humans have ever made. The first one was detected in 2015, and there's been tens, if not hundreds, of gravitational waves detected since then. I'm saying maybe not hundreds because not all of them are confirmed gravitational waves, but there's been a lot of them detected since that time.
Yeah, there's an app that you can download which pings you every time there's a confirmed gravitational wave discovery.
Nice.
From LIGO, which is pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, just to sort of emphasize on how delicate and how sensitive these equipments are, I built a laser interferometer once in my physics lab in undergrad. One cool implementation of an interferometer was we made holograms out of it. So that was pretty cool. But yeah, when someone was walking outside the window, our interferometer would move, the pattern would move. It's that sensitive. And we insulated it the best we could, putting it on air tubes so that it does not feel vibrations and whatnot. So compared to that, I guess LIGO would be a lot more sensitive as well.
Yeah, it is a lot more sensitive. And maybe that's also another piece and why people even kind of felt like the detection from LIGO and Virgo were, they weren't actually gravitational waves from space, is because, as right. you just demonstrated, like there's lots of things that can cause the lasers to move. So a noise, like knowing what's noise and what's a signal is a really big piece of that research, and especially for the technicians who work on the ground there. And yeah. so LIGO also does a lot of work to make sure that they have their laser, the tubes, the mirrors that bounce things, like all that is insulated to prevent vibrations from Earth-based noise yeah. from getting in there. So you're really seeing astronomy based. And that's also why more than one detector is so important, because
exactly,
you yeah. could totally blame things on, like, it's a tectonic plate shift, or the transport truck was driving down the road, or something like that. My favorite one.
Or a bird moved,
yeah. And my favorite one is shotgun blasts in the Louisiana detector from people. Is it crocodiles or alligators in Louisiana? I don't know, but whichever one, whichever like swamp lizard it was like people were shooting shotguns too close to the detector and it was causing noise. This is my favorite story. And I think it is true, but it's still my favorite story, even if it's not. And yeah, that's why having more than one detector is so important, because you're not going to have the exact same noise happening at the exact same time yeah. with the exact same footprint in across the country or across the earth, globe. Like across the globe yeah. in different continents. You're not. So that's why yeah. having more than one detector is so important, is you can really isolate that noise and look for astrophysical signals, because certainly an astrophysical yeah. signal will be the same no matter where you are on Earth.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess it also kind of gives you a direction of where it's coming from, given the fact that you have multiple one of those spread across the globe, gives you an idea where the signal is coming from in the sky as well.
Yeah, that's exactly why you need more than one, and preferably more yeah. than three, because then yeah. you can use the same premise as the GPS signals using triangulation of yeah. satellites. It's a triangulation of laser interferometers.
Yeah, cool. I guess this sort of moves us into my next question as well. You talked about how there's more coming, more gravitational wave interferometers coming. So given your expertise on black hole mergers, what are some of the developments in both binary black hole mergers and gravitational wave detections that you're looking for? And this can be from the point of view of simulations and theoretical physics, as well as observation as well.
Yeah. So I just want to also highlight that this particular area of astrophysics is extremely fast paced. And I'm always nervous about saying like something specific, because chances are in like 2.5 weeks it'll happen, which is exciting and fantastic, but that means I have to change my tune again. And so I would say I'm not even gonna gesture to say anything about the theoretical side or the computational side, because that moves so right. quickly. But I will say that in terms of the observations, what I'm really looking forward to, I would love for us to see gravitational waves for sure from something that's not even a binary at all. I think it would be really rad to see gravitational waves from, say, supernova. That's one of the big hits. That's one of the big targets for tests of general relativity in particular, and learning more about supernova. Yeah. I'm also really looking forward to a couple more things. I'm looking forward to us finding black holes and what we call the mass gap. So we talked about stellar mass black yeah. holes, which are, you know, more than 5 times the mass of the sun, but less than 100 times the mass of the sun. And we talked about supermassive black holes, which are more than 100,000 times the mass of the sun, and usually up in the millions. But we also have a third kind that's called intermediate mass black holes. And those are the ones that are in between. And there's a couple yeah. of candidates for sure, but they haven't been confirmed. So I'd love yeah. to see a confirmation of like an intermediate mass black hole that you can point at and be like, that's where one exists in the night sky. Right. That would be amazing. And then kind of back on the target of laser interferometers and observing binaries would be some of these what we call third generation and later detectors that are coming out. So LIGO and Virgo and GEO-600, LIGO India, Kagra, these are all laser interferometers that are currently operation or will be soon. And they're all ground-based, and I kind of already yeah. said my punchline, ELISA is one that's going to be space-based. And I am so excited to see that go up. the timeline keeps getting shifted. So again, I'm not even going to estimate when that's really going to happen. But it should be sensitive enough to detect binaries of supermassive black holes, so galaxy mergers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, nice. And so all the stuff that we're going to be able to know about and learn about through ELISA is going to be incredible. And again, a space-based laser interferometer, you're going to have, like, even just all the cool engineering that goes into that is just wild. And
quite cool technology.
It's really cool technology, yeah. So I'm really excited to see that come together and actually go into space and start telling us about supermassive black hole binaries, too.
Yeah. All right, great. I guess this makes us reach towards the end of the segment. But before I sort of end it, CJ, you hinted towards this mass gap in black holes. And just in case people are wondering what that's all about, we actually did a podcast on this as well. It was our third podcast ever episode where we talked about this record-breaking black hole collision. And so if you guys are interested, we released that in November of 2020. Please go ahead and have a look about what this mass gap of black holes really is. But for now, let's take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about sort of the other hat that CJ wears about knowledge translation and education consulting. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Connor again. While we are really proud of our content at the Queen's Observatory, we would be remiss if we didn't mention some of the other great resources out there. The MacDonald Institute, the Royal Astronomical Society, and the Astronomy on Tap programs are all very enthusiastic about bringing the universe down to Earth. Links to these online programs will be available in the podcast description. And with that, let's get back to this fascinating discussion.
And we're back. We have CJ over here with us, and we were just talking about black holes. Even though, CJ, I would love to continue talking about black holes because I have many more questions that I guess you would be the perfect person to answer. We do kind of want to focus now on the other parts of your job, which are also very interesting, and that's particularly science communication, science outreach, and education development for science. Let's start with what got you interested in science communication and why do you think it's important?
So I guess that's also kind of a hard question in terms of what got me started in it. I've always been really involved in science outreach initiatives. So like, you know, you volunteer to help with the observatory, you volunteer to, you know, talk to folks about your research, you volunteer for Let's Talk Science or Science Rendezvous and all of these other things that tend to happen as you're doing an undergraduate degree or graduate degree. Where you get to interact with the public and do fun stuff like that. And I guess the more I did it, the more I realized that there was a big kind of like missing piece in science knowledge and even science communication that it's always kind of touted as being so important. And it's important to share, you know, share knowledge and to make sure that, you know, research that's being done is well disseminated and so on and so forth. But if there's not actually a lot dedicated to that, so that's why I really started getting interested in it. And I think what's kind of interested me more than the science communication piece directly is also the science education. When I was doing my PhD at U of T, I also worked as a math and science teacher at a high school. And I was a planetarium operator with the Dunlap Institute. And I did a lot of work with the physics department at U of T for, you know, how to do training to teach, essentially. And so that was kind of where I focused more. And science communication is a natural part of that. So why is it important? I think that it's so important because even if someone doesn't care about the actual science content, like maybe you don't actually care about Maxwell's equation. And I mean, to be honest, I don't know if I actually care about the equations themselves, but I care about the consequence of them. it's like maybe you don't actually care about a specific phenomenon or a specific force or a specific whatever it is. And you're like, I don't actually care how airplanes fly. And also, if you're saying that to yourself, who are you? Everyone should care about how airplanes fly. But it's more like inspiring. It's like the secondary things. It's inspiring curiosity and asking questions. It's critical thinking, being able to do logic, being able to rationalize what comes next, predicting. And again, really emphasizing the rationality, the logic, and the critical thinking that comes with science education and science communication. That's really what motivates me to be kind of focused in this field, and why I decided to go down this route instead of continuing with research.
Okay, great. All right, so let's talk about some of your involvements here. You're involved in something called Discover the Universe. Tell us more about what this project is, Discover the Universe, and how you got involved in it and your interest in this.
Yeah. So I don't know if I would call Discover Universe a project. It's its own not-for-profit education platform. we have many projects within. So Discover the Universe is a Canadian-based...
Mega project.
And it's not mine. I am an employee of Discover the Universe, and right. the CEO or executive director, if you will, is Julie Baudat-Duvaux, who lives in Quebec. And we are... there's only a couple of employees. I'm just one of them. and the idea is to make astronomy education accessible and doable by teachers. So it's not really it's not going directly to students. It's very much focused on giving support and supplying resources for teachers and educators, both formal and informal, at every level, from, you know, like daycare, literally daycare level, all the way up through university and advanced education. To try and make sure that astronomy education is still relevant and doable for folks who are maybe usually not comfortable doing astronomy. Like maybe you're actually trained in chemistry and you're like, I'm not going to touch anything about the Earth Moon system. And it's like, well, here's a perfectly put together activity kit that's all about the Earth Moon system, phases of the moon, and eclipses. Here you go. Like that's the kind of thing that we do, as well as, you know, webinars. Training sessions, and we have an ambassador program as well for people to get involved and share the word about how cool astronomy education is.
Cool. I guess that's fairly interesting. So what are your roles in this project, particularly?
So my role with Discover the Universe right now is as an educational content developer. So that kind of falls into design and lead webinars, which is a session where we meet with teachers and we talk about usually one or two main topics, as well as some activities they can take away to do in their classrooms. I also help to design and build educational kits. And what we've done more recently as well is looking at things like direct outreach. So for example, we did a Eclipse 2021 project where we created and sent educational kits to many communities in Northern Ontario, Northern Quebec, and Nunavut for the eclipse that happened in 2021. And if you didn't know about it, that's because it happened at like 5 a.m. for most places.
Oh, right. That's true.
Yeah. It was barely visible in Toronto and Southern Ontario, but it was very much visible early in the morning in parts of Northern Canada.
Okay. Someone asked me whether I'm going to wake up to see that. And I was like, I'm not. And they were like, well, I guess you're not that good of an astrophysicist.
You got called out.
Or that's your limit. You're not going to wake up that early to see an eclipse. And I'm like, I've seen so many of them.
Oh my God, brutal. This point. But that's what I do with Discover the Universe. Talks and designing educational content and material.
So would you be able to give us some sneak peek about what are you working on currently with Discover the Universe?
Ooh. Well, right now, Discover the Universe, we're kind of in a designing phase. We're figuring out what's going to come next. I will say that we're looking at doing more, kind of like what we did for the Eclipse project. We don't normally make physical kits that like have the USBs and Eclipse viewers and worksheets and like actual physical material. We don't normally send out physical things. We normally stick to keeping things online and digital, and people can download sheets and print them themselves. But we're kind of thinking, we're kind of moving a little bit towards creating educational kits that people can, I'm going to say order with quotation marks, even though people can't see them. Order, because we're thinking about like kind of like giving them, like they would be sent for free, but you know, you would order them. We're kind of looking at getting more into that, as well as diving more into more extreme topics like black holes and the Earth's atmosphere, things that aren't normally covered in curricula.
Right. Maybe I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please keep going on after this. But when CJ said orders, he was putting this in double quotation marks, because that's not going to come out in the podcast. this is an order as in a nominal thing that you do. Just put your name in there. I think the idea is to keep them free, right, CJ?
Yeah, that's exactly it. We always aim to keep things free and accessible for everyone, which is even... and that's another feature of Discover the Universe, which I did not touch on, is that it's completely bilingual. So I myself am not bilingual in English and French, but Discover the Universe, everything we put out and everything we create is available in English and French, including the website has two different domains, discovertheuniverse.ca and découvertedelauniverse.ca.
Cool. So how can people find, so there are teachers listening over here for high schools and middle schools, how can people find more about the projects you're working on and maybe sort of use them in their classrooms?
Yeah, so the best way to keep up to date is to sign up for the Discover the Universe newsletter, which is directly available on the website, discovertheuniverse.ca, and also following us on various social medias, Facebook and Twitter in particular are our most. Right. I was thinking, it was like, which ones are our most available after Facebook? I think it's Facebook and Twitter are most common. And following us on those. But the newsletter, for sure, that'll keep everyone up to date on new blog entries, new webinars, when kits go live, and all of that great stuff.
Okay, great. Perfect. So let's switch gears here a little bit, because you have another job as well, which is something called knowledge translation specialist here at the McDonald Institute. That's an interesting title. What does a knowledge translation specialist do day to day?
I don't even know. It's something that I have to wrestle with every time someone, like, even if I go to, say, like, the dentist, and they're like, oh, what do you do for work? And I'm like, is that a can of worms I really want to start with you right now? Like, a knowledge translation specialist, I think, it's vague on purpose. It's vague on purpose because there's so many things that can fall into that category. And maybe also to be a little bit transparent as well, my full-time job is with the McDonald Institute as a knowledge translation specialist, and I also work part-time with Discover the Universe. So just to be clear, I'm not working two full-time jobs. That would be insane. So with the knowledge translation specialist, my duties kind of fall within two broad scopes, one of which is science communication directly, which is usually taking cutting-edge research in astroparticle physics, so like neutrinos and dark matter, and expressing them in a little bit easier to absorb mechanism than a whole 40-page paper, which is usually a 10 to 15 minute or sometimes even short little bullet posts in news articles. Other side is a little bit more maybe direct in terms of the actual, like, knowledge translation, like a vehicle to get knowledge from A to B, which is looking at our digital spaces such as our website, and other spaces like a recruitment tool, or how we communicate things in items such as communications with our community, as well as newsletters and things like that. I don't make the newsletters, but I do write some things for them. So it's both. It's the actual content as well as the vehicle through which the content gets conveyed.
Okay. Oh, great. Perfect. I guess we're coming towards the end of our segment over here. And now is the time to ask you this hard-hitting question, CJ. Because you are a scientist, and tell us, what is one advice you would give your past self, almost in hindsight, as a scientist, and maybe also as a science communicator, before you start doing research or getting involved in science communications?
So I think this actually works for both. I know that you can probably think, like, you know, what advice could possibly stretch both science communication as well as the science research part. And I honestly think that what I would say to myself is, don't be such a yes man. Like, it's okay to do everything. And that was something I struggled with all through my undergrad. It's something I definitely struggled with in grad school. It's something I still struggle with now, is that I have a tendency to do too much at the same time, like really piling your to-do list way too high, having a lot of expectations to get everything done and an inhumane ability. I would say to myself, you know, try and focus on the things that really line up with your passion, really line up with what you love to do. And it's okay to say no to the other things. Like, it's okay to say no to the fifth research project that you're taking on that semester. It's okay to say no to, you know, the extra admin duties that your supervisor is trying to put on you. Like, I would say, that's what I would say to to myself. And that also goes for science communication. Like, it's okay to say no to the eighth volunteer event of the week, you know, for science outreach. Like, it's okay to say no and to focus on a few things and be really passionate about those, as opposed to being spread way too thin.
Okay. I guess that's a very good thing to keep in mind, for sure. All right. So that brings us towards the end of this interview. Thank you, CJ, for coming to chat with us, telling us about black holes and science communication. It was an amazing chat, for sure. And I'm sure our listeners will also agree with me when I say this was fun.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And this is all from us here at Fast Radio Burst. And we will see you next time. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Queen's Observatory's Fast Radio Burst. We hope you enjoyed this walk through the universe. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to contact us via email at queensuobservatory@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter as the Queen's University Observatory to stay up to date. If you like this podcast, you can help us by leaving a review and sharing it with your friends. This will help us become more visible and spread the wonders of the universe to more people. That is all from us. We'll be back again with another exciting topic in astronomy.